Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning in to Does Not Compute. Today, I want to tell you about our sponsor this week, which is Datadog. Datadog is a SaaS monitoring and analytics platform. It provides developers and DevOps teams with a unified view of their infrastructure, providing metrics, distributed application traces, and logs all in one convenient platform. It's not just a log collection service. It actually monitors your application from front end to back end to the database to all the pieces in between, and it lets you take a deep dive into the individual traces that touch every part of your application. Their Application Performance Monitoring feature, or APM for short, lets you identify, analyze, and resolve performance issues all the way down to the code level for Python, Ruby, Go, Java, and Node.js applications. And for all you Elixir developers out there, there's even a third-party library called Spandex, which has integrations for Elixir applications as well as Ecto and Phoenix, so you can integrate those right into your Datadog traces as well. It's really easy to get started. There's over 250 turnkey integrations for things like AWS, Nginx, Kubernetes, Slack, and so much more. Installing the Datadog client on your server is as simple as a one-line command. So this week, Datadog is offering DNC listeners with a free trial, and as an added bonus for signing up and creating a dashboard, they'll even send you a free Datadog t-shirt. You can start your free trial today at datadog.com/doesnotcompute, and again, they'll send you a free t-shirt. That's at datadog.com/doesnotcompute.
It's Friday. It's somewhat Refactor Friday. I'm not refactoring things, but I'm knocking Trello cards down that have been around for a while.
That's good. That kind of counts-ish.
It feels good because it makes my boss happy, and the Trello is smaller, and it makes me happy when I see the Trello shrink. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Have you gotten a chance to do any kind of refactory things that we'd talked about recently? I mean, you've been pretty busy kind of with rolling out the new stuff, I guess. So
Actually,
prove me wrong.
I haven't been as busy because, yeah, so I described to my boss what the next step would be. I think I talked about the company inventory stuff, like changing around inventory works last time.
Yeah, we mentioned that.
Yeah, so I described it to my boss, and she was like, I told her like how long I think it would take, and she was like, let's do something else for now because I don't want to spend money on that right now when we can increase the number of people that we have to work on inventory, so we can increase our support staff, and it might be a little cheaper than sinking like a month of dev time into this thing when there are other pressing things to do, which I guess makes sense. So if I can focus my time on something that affects the bottom line right now, I guess it makes sense to do that. So that's what I've been doing.
Okay. And what's that?
So I've been helping Paul out with his coupon stuff.
Yep.
That has been happening. So just kind of, we do everything in Google Docs. So he has a doc and I would look through the doc, and then we do like a pair programming session where, I guess we didn't really even do much programming on that one. It was more or less like, let's look at how the checkout stuff works right now and see where this stuff slots in, the coupon stuff slots in. So the coupon stuff is going in. I don't even know if I've talked about that implementation. Anyway, so we're adding coupons, which every e-commerce system needs. But this, the way it's set up is that each store can specify the coupons they want to use.
Oh yeah, you mentioned this. We're having different like triggers based off of their behavior and stuff.
Yeah, so that's the second part. The first part is just the coupons and the frameworks to be in place for a store to say, I want to offer this much in store, this much online, and here are the parameters. So it expires after X usage, or expires after X time, or never expires, or whatever. So we have basically that set up where stores can do that. So Paul's working through the UI and finishing up sort of the back end side of the API. And then the second half of it is stores being able to basically assert, I think that X action on our site is worth Y money via a coupon. So they can create coupons, and then we're also having this thing called the coupon generator, I guess. That's certainly the formal term for it, but that's what it does. And so a store can attach a coupon that's generated when an action happens, and the store can decide what action that is, whether it's like a user following them or a user favoriting a product. And they can say this action is worth this coupon or this percent discount to me, basically. So it's kind of like a setup where the stores can choose what they want to offer a discount for and how much they want to offer that for.
Now, when you're generating coupons, do they have Do they have codes?
Yeah.
How are you generating those codes?
Well, are you talking about the generated ones or the ones that the stores just make?
Well, like a randomly generated code.
Oh, that's just attached to a user.
Right, but how do you generate it?
When it's
I mean, like physically making the characters, like A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever.
Oh, if it's attached specifically to a user account, the user can regenerate it, and it's, I don't remember how.
Sorry, there's no like publicly available code that they have to like type in or whatever. It's like just the URL.
Yeah. So basically it's attached to their account and they can choose to use it if they want to. And then they get the coupon, so we can mail them like a representation of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really like a GUID or anything like that. I don't know exactly how it's generated, but.
Oh, okay.
Because Paul's doing the implementation, but that's how it works.
Okay.
So when you do something, you get some sort of positive response. I guess maybe that's not the right way to say it. You get a goodie for doing a thing, and stores are completely in control of that stuff.
That's cool. And just the reason I asked was because like we had a kind of not really a coupon. I guess we kind of had a coupon based system for RHR for like new signups. You could redeem things for discounts or for, you know, free credit or whatever. And I ended up using like a third party library just to generate the coupon codes, because there's lots of edge cases that you like really don't think about or like are really easy to screw up. Like, for example, when you generate a coupon code, you don't want to have both the number one and the letter I in it, right?
Okay.
Or a zero and an O. So like it strips out any ambiguous characters, fives and Zs, that kind of things.
Anything that makes it hard for a person to redeem it.
Yeah. And then also does stuff like checks it for an accidentally generated naughty word, right? From a dictionary.
Yeah.
And it's just funny little things. It's actually adapted. I use this Ruby gem. I think it was this one called Coupon Code that is actually based off of Perl code that like they just basically ported this Perl CPAN library to Ruby for generating these little coupon codes. Yeah. Pretty funny.
That's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't really thought that much about it because Paul's doing kind of the nitty gritty stuff. I've just been I have a lot of institutional knowledge about the current checkout system and how all that stuff works with sales tax and the calculations and all that stuff. So that's where I've been kind of helping a lot is overall. Yeah, it'd be cool to have coupons generated off an action. You know, that was kind of like a group that happened on a group call. Someone had an idea. And that's kind of where the generator system came out of it. But I've been kind of helping with saying, yeah, this is how a thing works. Even though he's been working here for a while, there's only two of us still, so it's hard to keep all that stuff in the front of your memory. So I've been kind of helping illuminate things like that. Like here's maybe a good place where you could insert this into the stack. Because really what we want is we want a pipeline for an order, and order can go through the pipeline and gets transformed in different ways. And so we're basically adding a coupon calculation into the pipeline, and the pipeline does what it needs to do, whether it's calculating numbers and then updating line item rows, and then also calculating numbers and updating the order total rows and stuff like that. So yeah, we're just kind of like putting the coupon layer into the stack there. And so I was helping him find the best spot to do that.
Yeah, that's cool. And you have a better, because you've been working on this stuff more recently, you've got a really good high-level picture of how it all pieces together.
It's interesting still, because there's a lot of stuff, you know, speaking about refactoring, there's a lot of stuff I want to just rewrite. I would love to rewrite the whole thing, because what we have now is a sort of a translation of what we had from the MVP, which I didn't write. And there are some things that I don't necessarily agree with, or some things I think that could have been done better, or in a more organized manner. And so I think that's mainly part of it. If things were a little bit more organized, it might be easier for Paul just to jump in and get stuff done. But there's a lot of like, why is this the way it is? And then I have to think back 2 years ago and be like, oh yeah, so the Ruby code used to do this, and then we had to go and make it do this, and then there was a change here, and then it has to work this way. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a whole thing. It's funny because the longer I work on this, and again, there's only two of us, so it's not, I guess, exactly the same as when I hear people talking about working on an app with a bunch of different coworkers, and they're talking about maintaining a legacy code base. I'm getting a small taste of it, but it's like I'm doing it to myself.
Yeah, you don't have it that bad, trust me.
But what were we talking about? Refactoring. Yeah, so I haven't been that busy. I've been working on, you know, helping Paul kind of work that out. And while I'm doing that, There's some shipping stuff that I'm looking at doing, and so I'm waiting on you ship for some answers back. And so basically what I told my boss was like, I'm just going to focus on the Trello while these things are kind of spinning in the air. Like, these plates are spinning over here. I'm going to go and take care of these things and come back when I get everything that I need, so that way I can make progress on these items. So I don't mean I'm not busy in the sense that like I'm just sitting around, but there's not like a significant mental drain on me every day.
Yeah, you've got your, you made the kind of big push for that, you know, you're hard and deep in that one feature for a while. And now you can kind of come up and get some air and you know, reevaluate and knock off some other stuff. That's good.
It's funny because I spent so much time building out this thing and it needed to be done at some point. And so I spent like a month building this multi-store setup, and now there's like three stores that use it, and we knew there were only going to be three stores that are going to be using it, but it's something that will be used more as we go. So it was kind of like anticlimactic. I was like, after a whole month of working on this thing, it's out. I'm like, okay, what do now?
That's the best possible outcome though. Like,
yeah,
you launched it with your, you know, sweaty palms on a Saturday, and there were no issues, like, it's right?
There weren't any big issues. There's small tweaks and things that I kind of glossed over, but...
Well, okay, but like, you didn't, you know, bring the store down.
Nobody got charged money when they shouldn't have been charged money.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it does. I can see why I'd be anticlimactic, but that's kind of the way you want it sometimes.
One of the hardest things one of the things that I struggle with the most is, this might be a bad way to put it, but educating your teammates when terminology changes or when new terminology is introduced. And I don't mean educating them to sound negative or bad, but I don't know how else to describe it. Do you know what I mean? So like, when you introduce a new concept into an app and you have to explain to your coworkers and your non-technical coworkers, like, here's this new word that we have to know about, and here's what it means, and here's how it affects what you already know about this application. I find that to be one of the most difficult things about being a CTO or being a developer that is in the position to like make those changes and make those decisions.
Yeah, you almost have to market it, right? Like, it's not like you're trying to sell the feature to them, but you have to market it and brand it and give it a name, like, in a way that, yeah, people have you need a common language, a common, you know, vernacular way to talk about things. Like,
yeah,
if you don't have that common understanding and terminology of how the pieces fit together, that's just gets confusing real fast, you know, especially when it comes to like documentation or supporting or talking to customers. Like, you all need to be on the same page.
Yeah, it's hard because I'll write all the documentation. Like, I wrote all the help docs and intercom and all that stuff. And I said, hey, yeah, everyone read over this and ask me any questions or things. If something's confusing, ask me so I can address it here before customers see it. And, you know, everything goes through and I make changes and all that stuff. But then like a week later, I'm still getting questions from coworkers, and they're like, hey, they'll say something and I'll have to rephrase it back to them. Like, you say this, but what you're actually saying to me, you say to me A, but what you're actually saying to me is B. So like, you're asking about a store thing, but I'm like, that's a company thing. So it's like old habits die hard, I guess. I don't know.
I think it just goes back to people don't read. And really it's just going to take, you know, it's going to take time and experience with the new system for people to adopt those new behaviors.
Yeah. Do you have firsthand experience with that?
I don't know. I don't have a good example. Sorry.
that's totally fine. If someone listening has an example, let me know, because it's just something I've been mulling over recently. Cause I don't want to come across as passive aggressive. I'm more concerned about like interpersonal relationships on the team, and maybe it's just my personality, but I don't want to be like correcting people all the time, or I don't want to like go around, there's a chat happening and I jump in, actually, this is, you know, you're incorrect and this is what it is. I don't like that feeling, but sometimes I find myself having to like reword things. So like, if someone asks me a question, in my answer, I will use the correct terminology and I'll make an effort to make that apparent that the terminology is different without explicitly saying like, hey, you said this wrong, or this isn't how it works, or do you understand what I'm trying to say there? Like,
you don't always want to be like the cop. You don't always want to be the bad cop, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds kind of lazy or irresponsible, but really sometimes just the best thing you can do is just like sit back and wait for people to come to you. You know what I mean? Like just passively let people kind of understand that what they're saying is in, or doing is incorrect. You know, it's kind of the mindset that if you wait long enough to solve a problem, the problem just goes away. Just like a terrible way to think about things, but totally true. Like people will solve problems on their own if they're, you know, motivated to. I don't think you have to be proactive in it necessarily, but you know, as long as people know that you're like the go-to guy, if like they don't understand, as long as you have time and energy to support that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know. There's no good way to handle it, right? Because like you said, it's, I mean, is it like a design thing? Like, can you design the application in such a way that it's more self-serving and, you know, more clear about what's going on? Or is it not really the crux of the problem?
It's not the crux of the problem. I think it's just everyone's busy and everyone's answered 1,000 questions. And so they're in a rhythm of answering questions a certain way.
Sure.
And yeah, I think part of it is just the speed at which things move in a small company, especially a technology-based startup, because things can change so quickly. And for Paul and I, it was like a month of this giant change. We're in it, the thick of it, and our coworkers are not. They're selling what we have right now, and they're supporting what we have right now. And so even though we've had meetings and we've updated documentation and talked about, hey, here's the new things you need to be aware of, they're aware of it, but it's not like the first thing to come into memory because they've been so actively, for that month, they weren't doing what I was doing, right? They weren't immersed in it, I suppose. But I don't know how it works at bigger companies too. I don't know that it's any better because we've all been in like support scenarios where someone says something and someone else above their head comes in and is like, that's not true.
Yeah.
That's not, yeah. It happened to me recently, actually, with one of the software vendors that we work with, where we reported what we thought might have been a bug, and our account rep was like, yeah, that sounds like a bug. And then someone above was like, actually, that's not what these numbers mean. This is what they mean. And we're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and that doesn't look great from the outside either when there's that kind of dissonance.
Yeah, yeah.
Not intentional. It's not like anyone's trying to undermine anyone. It's just a, I don't know, lack of information.
People have a lot of stuff going on. I think that's what it boils down to. Everyone's got stuff going on, especially in a small company. But yeah. Anyhow, I sent you. Are you ready for the segue? I sent you a message this morning about HashiCorp raising 100 mil. And speaking of HashiCorp, you've been using Packer recently.
That was a little forced. I'll allow it.
Yeah. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is
I don't want to like edit you, but
yeah.
Speaking of people who are busy all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been knee deep in this, elbow deep, chest deep, even in this DevOps world over at Glance Networks. What started out as a side gig has turned into pretty much all of my waking hours and energy, but in a good way, in a totally good way, because I've over the past several weeks, it's been about a little over a month now, made a lot of really, really great progress. And I think where we last left off of this was a couple weeks ago where we were talking about, so basically this new side gig at Glance is I'm helping them improve, just kind of streamline their build and deploy process, right? And so last we talked, I was contemplating like, well, there's all this extra logic that we need for starting up and stopping servers. And it's like, I really didn't want to build like a whole extra piece of infrastructure just to handle that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, like when a server starts up, it should be able to identify who it is. It should be able to get an IP address from this pool of static IP addresses that we have reserved, set its host name, configure itself, do what it needs to do. Turns out that was a vast oversimplification of the problem, right? Like the more I learned about this, the more I get into it, it turns out there's a lot more requirements besides like just that one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's all the auto-scaling logic. So like the servers have TCP connections on them and like you can't shut down a server while you people are connected to it. But you want the connections to drain off eventually. So like we're going to have to build this logic where like, okay, the server has like maybe like two people left on it or something. And so we'd have to disable it and tell the application like, hey, don't accept any more connections. and then wait for it to drain off to zero, then disable termination protection, and then let the autoscaler scale it down. Like, there's all this extra stuff that needs to happen. So long story short, I've got a new little Phoenix, little Phoenix app,
yeah,
that I started building to handle that stuff. And I just call it Depot because it's kind of like, I don't know, checking in and out of things.
Yeah, no, it seems really interesting to me the way, because last time we talked about it, I was like, why not use some container orchestration thing here, you know, some whole, like, why not adopt an entire new ecosystem? And you were like, eh, let's not break things. Let's try to just get things working first. And yeah, so you were talking about, at that point, I think you were even talking about using Packer and just, you know, just a couple of files here and there that helps build what you need. And then I think you sent me a mixphoenix.new command. And I was like, oh, what's this? And then after a while, you sent me, I think it was a screenshot of Insomnia where you were making a request and it was returning JSON with instance or information about different running instances.
Yep. That's where I've gotten with that. So like now what happens when a new server comes up, it just does a curl command, right? Just a regular HTTP request to this little Depot web app. And then that web app goes to AWS's APIs and like figures everything out.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about it is I don't actually, this is a Phoenix app that's API only. So there's no front end for it right now and no database. There's no Ecto even at all.
Hmm.
So it was, you know, mixed Phoenix, no Ecto, no Brunch.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Webpack or whatever. Did I use 1.4? I think I used 1.4 for Phoenix in this one. Anyway, it's like complete bare bones API app. And it's like, it's so fast and clean. I just love it having that nice clean slate.
It's almost like you're making a one click app installer that Dio has where it's like all API based and but you click on it, you set your settings and there's a request that goes out to their infrastructure that builds the instances that you configured and returns you a thing.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I did was, so you can do like /register.json and it'll give you a JSON payload back. Or if you just do /register, because this is mostly just going to be like shell scripts that are calling, doing this API call, it actually returns like a plain text formatted response that's formatted like a shell script, like environment variables, like variable equals X, variable equals Y, variable equals Z, all formatted just like a regular plain environment file. And that's really nice because then I can just take that and evaluate it directly in my shell scripts and then just like keep going as if, you know, I basically just consume the API response, but I don't have to worry about, you know, having a jQuery or excuse me, then I don't have to worry about having a JSON parser.
Yeah. Yeah. I think because you had mentioned, what did you say to me? You said something specifically about, oh, you were showing me the screenshot and you're like, oh, also there's also another way. So you can get JSON or you can get a shell script set up basically. And I was like, why would you need that? And then it clicked like as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, you're evaluating that on the machine.
Yeah. It makes it basically free to get the responses right back.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So how does Packer fit into this whole picture? Because now you have this API that kind of handles a communication to AWS and seeing what's available and kind of, you know, making them happen via the requests. So where does Packer fit into all this?
So Packer actually happens before any of that. So Packer just builds the image like the plain old way that it's supposed to be built, but making it totally like agnostic, like it doesn't know anything about a specific like host name or anything like that, right? So Packer at this point is just, it actually pulls down a tarball of the release from S3. It installs all the dependencies, puts all the files in the right place, and then just like shuts it down and takes a snapshot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I use this thing called launch templates. And then with the launch template, what we do is, okay, I'm using this image, launching it, you know, with this size, with these tags, you know, you configure how you want to launch the image. But then you can also put in what's called user data. And user data is basically just an arbitrary shell script that you can run on the very first time that box boots. And so that's where I do the special little customization with contacting the Depot. When the box comes up, curls, configures itself, and then it reboots, and then it's up. And it's cool. So what I did was I the way the box identifies itself is through tags. So I have a glance type, which is the type of the server. We have four different server applications now that I have to support. So glance type tag and the glance version tag, which is, you know, just the application version. And that's how it knows how to configure itself. It's just purely based off of the tags. So it's all just stored in metadata, which is nice because then you can look at the server in AWS and know exactly how it's configured. And also, you know, you don't have to keep track of it. Again, you don't have to keep track of it in a database. It's all just metadata in AWS.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot, but it's actually, like, all things considered, it's pretty simple setup.
Yeah, it's like trying to piece together a lot of different things, a lot of small specialized things is like, that's like the number one, it's the number one skill of doing DevOps stuff. It's like, okay, how does this fit with this other thing? How do I link them together so that, you know, securely and like efficiently? And there's lots of tools out there, but that, you know, if you could start from scratch, you could use a way more modern way of doing this.
Sure.
You know, there's, like you said, there's all kinds of ways to orchestrate these type of things that you can get out of the box now, but that's going to be a lot easier if you have a greenfield application, right? Something that you can plan for how you're going to deploy it and how it's going to run and how it needs to work. You know, I'm not a developer on this team. I can't go in and change the source code to behave how I want it to.
Yeah.
I just have to orchestrate it. So we just kind of have to work with what we got. And you know what? So far, it's been really nice. Like this little server's just been chilling there and I've got it behind a load balancer and secured it with an API key, you know? So like it just sits there. It's a little tiny instance. And you know, when it comes time to put this in production, it'll be nice and redundant. And again, you don't have to worry about keeping track of a database or backups or anything. And the best part is, when I deployed this little Depot app, I used Packer to deploy it. Right? Why not? It's another tool in my toolbox now.
Yeah. So is everything just sort of in like a JSON file, a Yammer file? That's why you don't need a data store? The server configurations, I mean.
No, everything's pulled dynamically from the tags.
Okay.
Yeah. So like everything that the server needs is just defined on it itself.
Oh, I mean like the glance, the Depot app itself.
Yeah, no, it doesn't have any JSON or anything in it. It's just, again, it's just pulling AWS for what it needs to know.
Gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's where I missed it. Yeah, that's where I missed it. So Glance just gets the information from AWS, and then the machines just work with Glance, and they don't have to know about AWS, or if you were to switch to DigitalOcean or another cloud provider, you could theoretically just put another layer into the API and the machines would just still only work with Glance.
Yeah, that's...
Or Depot.
I know what you meant. Yeah, that's Depot. Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty far-fetched. Like, it's not designed for that. And because everything does rely pretty heavily right now on the way AWS works.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing precluding that. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that could happen.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So that's been pretty successful so far. And like I've got a good platform now where I can start adding this more complex, you know, way to monitor all the different server types. And eventually I'll probably like build a UI for it, just a simple, probably Nuxt, you know, like a simple little thing with a little WebSocket where I can watch in real time all the servers, right? Just to like a status page, basically, and just to see what's going on behind the scenes, right? Why not?
I like that.
Yeah. See, that's like, it'll just kind of be built that way. So I can just kind of tack that on later if I want.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like a perfect solution for what they needed.
Yeah.
Not an over-engineered, not introducing a whole ecosystem, a whole tool chain. It's just like, here's what you have that works now. We make a little adjustment and here's a new tool that fits into that adjustment and you're good to go.
So I was kind of worried. One of my hesitations with doing this initially was like, I think we talked about this a little bit, was like being the new guy and like trying to impose kind of new stacks or new technology or like things that people aren't familiar with into like an existing environment.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, I was expecting some pushback or skepticism, like, okay, why are you using this? Nobody's heard of Elixir. Like, you know, what is this thing?
Right.
Is this even going to, you know, run in a year? Whatever. Those are just kind of my internal dialogue. And like, I started working with another developer there because we actually need one more piece of this puzzle, and that's the ability for the depot to talk to the Glance servers and be able to like configure things with that as well. So basically we need an API on the Glance side of things to be able to talk to. Right.
Yep.
So I had to work with this other developer to like propose it. I was like, hey, this is what we need. And I met with him, and again, I was expecting a pushback, and he's like, oh, so what's this thing? It's the Elixir thing? I'm like, well, yeah, it's built off of Erlang, and it's a little web server thing. And like, as soon as I explained to him, he's like, okay, sounds good.
Yep.
And then he's like, what do you need from me? And then he immediately pulled open Google Docs and like started drawing a block diagram.
Yep.
As we're talking in the call. I'm like, this is perfect. And he just...
I like that.
It was awesome. Yeah. He's like, so it's called the Depot, and we'll keep going with the railway theme, and we'll call this little app Rail Spur, and I don't know, he just connecting things. I was like, okay, so clearly they have no aversion to just like these little quote-unquote microservices to, you know, just accomplish individual tasks and you know, piece together.
Sure. I mean, it's if I'm thinking about it, and I was working with a contractor and I needed a service spun up, I think I would probably be fine with that too. Because the whole thing that you're building is not to say that the work is easy, but it's a very small piece of the puzzle. And if it lives on its own and it runs and it's stable, then I don't ever have to worry about it. And if I do need to, it wouldn't really take me that time to become like to come up to speed with everything that I would need to know to be able to make changes or fix something if I really had to. It wasn't like you're proposing a giant monolithic app, I suppose, for this thing. You're just saying, here's a small modular tool. It's going to run. It's going to be fast. And it's going to sit over here. That's about all you need to know about it.
Yeah, that's basically it. And yeah, when you phrase it like that, it doesn't actually seem like that big of a deal, right?
Yeah. It doesn't to me. If I were working with someone and we needed something done, and then obviously I'm paying that person because I think that what they have to say is of weight, of meaning, right? And so if someone's like, hey, Go is the best language to solve this problem that you have right now, and it's going to live over here, and it's going to be this kind of like its own little contained thing, I'd probably be like, yeah, sounds good. You know, because it empowers them to do what I need them to do and what I'm paying them to do, and it empowers me to be productive in what I'm doing in our main application, right?
Yeah, and that was one of my motivations for learning and using Packer as well for even deploying this little depot app, was because they don't even have to know like the requirements for running it. Like, let's say, you know, catastrophically, like something happens and the server gets deleted and the image gets deleted, and right, like there's no way for someone to, like, they need to spin this thing back up. Well, literally just in the README, it's just like Packer build template, and then it just like will literally from scratch build a new little server to host this little tiny application, right? So like even the deployment process is just like a one-line command. Like that's great for me as a lazy developer who can't remember things.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, it just gives you a little bit more security for, okay, I might not understand how this thing works, but let's at least get it running, right? And talking on this port. So that's been pretty positive experience.
It's funny how you talk about being a developer that can't remember anything. And I'm looking at, I have Notion up right now, and I actually have a DKHQ workspace in Notion, and I have a code snippets area where I paste things.
Oh no.
So I can go find them later. So for example, I've been reskinning some emails and adding some new data that we have that we didn't have when I first made the emails. And I have a bunch of snippets for pasting in, like sending different, like varying quantities of emails to myself so I can look at designs and test things. Yeah, so I just have documents full of snippets that I copy and paste all the time. Anyway, that sounds perfectly reasonable. Nothing about that weirds me out. Or if I were in a similar position, I don't think that it's interesting. So like when I was doing consulting and I was working MVPs, I was the thought about longevity, I guess, wasn't there. So now when I make decisions, I think to myself, okay, I have this now, and this is just part of what we have. Whereas before, when I was trying to turn things over quickly, it was like, okay, we have to solve this problem. Let's slap this thing on it and then keep moving. You know, because right, that makes money for the business, right? Obviously, you don't want to make crap software, but it doesn't make sense to spend a whole bunch of time spinning on something and making something truly custom if it's a one-off build and you're never going to have to use, like, solve that problem again, right? And so now that I'm working on the same app for an extended period of time, it's like, okay, we have this and it's here now and I know about it. And I don't know, it like changed how I approach things and think about adding dependencies and things like that. So I think now I'm far more skeptical of libraries than I am of, okay, let's spin up a server and let another app that handles this thing live over here, if that makes sense.
That's an interesting distinction, because it's two different ways to solve a problem, like that potentially could solve the same problem. Having to babysit a whole other box or instance or application seems like a lot of mental overhead, but is it really? What are you losing as opposed to having to keep track of this kind of dependency that's kind of jammed to a bigger thing? I don't know. I guess that's a trade-off that you have to think about. It kind of goes back to the monolith versus microservice.
Yeah.
Kind of debate almost if you take it that far.
Yeah.
You have a microservice for every single function call in your application, right?
I'm not down. So I've tried to contribute to some Node apps that were like that. And I was like, this is too much to even get things up and running so I can make a simple style change or make a simple a tweak or something. It's like, okay, now I have 12 apps running. I mean, that's a little hyperbolic. Now I have 6 apps running on my computer, and I have, it's a lot. And I guess in the context of Design Collective, things are monolithic and it's been working fine. But we've had to do some other things. So it's not exactly the same, but adding Elasticsearch into our stack, it adds an external dependency in another server, certainly. So it's a whole thing, but it wasn't okay, to try and solve this problem, let me pull in a bunch of application dependencies that could potentially affect the code that I'm running day in, day out, if that makes sense. I don't know. I think that some things are better off isolated and encapsulated in a microservice, right? And when I was doing the quick turnaround, that was never the thing. It was like the monolith with it was like a bus with roller skates on top of it, and you know what I mean, going down. It was like a Goofy movie when they're driving down the highway and he's got a mile of things strapped to the top of his car. Does how I'm explaining that make more sense about how I'm kind of thinking about it, I suppose? Yeah. Sometimes you just want to put stuff in an actual trailer behind your car, not strap it to the top.
Sorry, just Goofy movie. Bringing back the deep Goofy movie cuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so by the way, the alternative to me writing this little standalone little server was, okay, we've got load balancers, and you have this thing called AWS Lambda, which is serverless functions,
mm-hmm.
which I think I mentioned before, and they have to be either Node, Python, Java, C#, or Go. Which I was not really keen on doing any of those, to be honest, because then you have to learn, you're writing AWS Lambda, but then you have to learn the APIs that run on AWS Lambda, right? The little framework that you have to do, in addition to, using a language that you might not be comfortable with and someone else has to know. And then you have to have your custom logic in there and hope that it's flexible enough that you can actually, finagle it to do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to piece it together with triggers using notifications and alarms and all this stuff that's built into AWS. You can do it. You can do it all out of the box. But man, it's like a cork board with tacks in it and just string everywhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it feels like. And it basically, it's impossible to recreate reliably. How do you've got all these things spread across these different services. How do you even check that they're correct and coherent and actually functioning as one? It just seemed like such a challenge versus just run the thing, open the port, do the curl. It's good.
Yeah.
It's fine.
when you describe all that, it in my mind, I was picturing a neighborhood and people were, they had the strings and the cups, and there's just strings all over the place. I don't like that. I don't like it. It certainly makes what's the saying? Start a monolithic. You start monolithic and you grow into a microservice if you need it. That seems to me to make the most sense, but I don't know. There was recently an article I read. Segment had an article about how they microserviced a bunch of stuff And then they're like, oh no. And they went back the other way and they had it. Again, like, it's a case by case basis. So what I'm trying to say is I don't think these things are concrete set in stone rules of engineering, but
yeah, whenever you talk in generalities about programming problems, it just ends in tears. There's no,
yeah.
It's everything is, but especially this where like, yeah, it just felt like the right solution for solving the problem, at least for right now. Like, you know, there's nothing precluding it from changing in the future. But it certainly meets our needs, and it's what's small and fast and easy to deploy, and it works. Like, what more do you want? right.
Yeah. You keep things moving. It's a simple solution. Money comes into the bank still. Like, that's the important thing. Everyone still has a job. That's, you know what I mean? That's the most important thing at the end of the day.
And then on the flip side, you have something like Uber's tech stack. Have you ever seen this? Their series of blog posts about how Uber works.
I don't think I have.
I'll put that in the show notes. It's from someone who doesn't really know. Like, it's like that scene from Good Burger. It's like, mm-hmm. I know some of these words.
Good Burger, that's a throwback.
We're all about the 90s references today. Yeah, they're just like list off every little piece of technology that everything runs on. It's cool to see how they piece everything together. But man, it's intimidating when you look at it at a high level like that, and you're like, oh god, all the different dependencies. It almost starts to look like a node dependency tree.
Yeah, I try to think, because when I read articles and in these tech articles and Medium articles, I read them through my perspective because I am me and I have the experiences that I have, right? But what often isn't like in the front of my mind is this company has a full team of people building and maintaining this stuff.
Oh yeah, that changes the economy of it completely, right?
But I never think about that. That doesn't ever dawn on me. I look at it and I'm like, my god, I would never do this.
Yeah, that's true. It does pay to have a little bit of context there.
Yeah, anyhow, that's what it's like to be me, is I have that.
You're not a multi-million dollar, you know, company by yourself.
Maybe one day.
Come on, are you even trying?
Am I TJ Holloway? Chuck, is that how you say his name?
Yeah, you lost me there.
You don't know who TJ is? I'll put him in the show notes. He's made like half the thing. Well, I can't say that. I'm not going to say that because it's not fair to a lot of people. He's made many Node packages for Node. He made Express, for example. He also has a company called Apex, Apex.sh. I think it's just him, but he makes products. Like, he has uptime monitoring and latency monitoring and different things like that he makes on his own. But I don't know. I'm not claiming that he's made multi-millions of dollars, and I'm not claiming that he made all of the Node packages, but he made quite a few. Anyhow, I should probably finish the workday now.
Well, yeah. So, I have to go immediately after we hang up. I have to go back on a pair, quote-unquote, pair programming session with Lee. That's what we've been doing for the past 2 days straight, is hacking on Packer scripts while he's basically virtually looking over my shoulder.
Oh my.
Screen sharing as we like piece together these shell scripts and dependencies and hacking through Ubuntu weirdness. And
speaking of, I've been using Ubuntu this whole week, and just today it crashed twice on me, so I'm back on my Mac.
Oh no.
That's a topic for another show.
Okay.
There you have it. Everyone has to come back next week and hear about that. They can't not listen to it.
Okay. I can't wait.
We got to clickbait in.
So I got to go back to this, because we have to have two of these servers in production in 2 hours from now.
Oh.
And then I can start my weekend. So.
Well, I should shut up then.
Wish me luck.
Well, okay then. Let's wind this puppy down.
All right.
Feedback. We love it. Thank you for the feedback. Tweet. Make me happy during the long work week where I'm up in the tundra by myself in a room with my computers.
The tundra? It's the 2nd of November.
It snowed the other day, all right?
Oh.
I'm not going outside.
Oh, poor baby.
All right. Feedback, appreciation. Thank you for talking to me.
And you can talk at Sean Washbot on Twitter. I'm Shrockwell on Twitter. That's SCH. And DNC Show is the DNC Show Twitter,
yeah.
In case you didn't follow that.
Yes. And also we put the show notes at dnc.show. So if you want to check out the links that we talked about today, they'll be there and you can click on them.
You can find those sweet, goofy movie references.
I'll find the whole thing on YouTube and put it up.
It's actually like 12. It's a 12 playlist. It's a 12 movie playlist, each of them 10 minutes.
You got to get to the Powerline concert.
Oh, that's what they're called. I was trying to remember that. Spectrum.chat, we're hanging out. We'll have the show notes over there as well. And if you want to check out some job boards, our podcast network, spec.fm, has a job board over at spec.fm/jobs. Lots of cool stuff over there.
Yeah, it looks like they got some new jobs. Datadog, Envision, looking for some people. VSCO, they actually make a really cool photography app for the iPhone. They're hiring as well. So go in and check those jobs out.
Cool.
As always, thank to Spec for having us and putting up with ourselves. And if you haven't checked out some of the other shows on the network, like Design Details, you should probably do that. They're really great. Design Details has taught me a lot about the design world, and I'm very thankful for that show. There's also other shows like Fragmented, which is about Android development, and Swift Unwrap, which is about, as you would might guess, the Swift world.
This episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Shipping and whatever.
All right. See ya. Once again, we'd like to thank Datadog for sponsoring this week's episode of Does Not Compute. Datadog really is the performance analytics solution that your application needs. With their powerful trace filtering, deeply integrated metrics, and a beautiful dashboard, it's easier now than ever to identify, analyze, and resolve performance issues that are affecting your application. You can start a free trial today at datadog.com/doesnotcompute, and Datadog will send you a cool free t-shirt. Again, that's at datadog.com/doesnotcompute for a free trial.
And Swift Unwrap, which is about, as you would might guess, the Swift world.
Thought it was just about birds.
Swift. Is there a bird? Is there a bird species breed called Swift? Do you call a bird? It's not a bird breed. It's a species, right?
Breed.
The breed of bird. I don't know.
You ever looked at the Swift logo?
It's Friday.
It's a Swift.
I mean, I've seen it, but I've embarrassed myself.
You ever looked at the Elixir logo? It's a drop of Elixir. Here, looked at the Go logo.
It's a swallow. That's why I was confused.
It's a type of swallow.
The Swift logo is a swallow.
It's a Swift. It's a type of bird.
I've never heard of that type of bird in my life.
Don't gaslight me here. Wikipedia. I don't want to talk about it.
I'm not going to do that.